Ms. Jadlowski, good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone. Excuse me. Good morning, and may it please the court. Katie Jadlowski, Assistant Douglas County Public Defender, on behalf of appellant Mr. Blaha. Mr. Blaha was convicted of serious offenses, assault in the first degree, and the use of a weapon, firearm, to commit a felony. He faced the possible penalty on count one of 1 to 50 years in prison, and on count two, the possible penalty of a mandatory minimum of 5 years to 50 years in prison. He was sentenced on count one to 30 to 40 years in prison, and on count two, a consecutive term of 15 to 30 years in prison. In this case, although the sentence didn't exceed the statutory limits for assault in the first degree and the use of a weapon to commit a felony, the court nonetheless abused its discretion. A sentencing court is to construct a sentence to fit the offender and not merely the crime. In this case, the court did seem to consider, at least to some extent, the factors in the guideposts that the Nebraska law has enumerated for consideration in sentencing.
Counsel, when you use the word consider, are you equating that or treating it as a synonym of expressing that verbally at the sentencing hearing?
In some instances, I think it is a synonym, and I think in this case, the court did explicitly verbalize his thoughts, and he said, these are some of the notes I made. Generally, I don't necessarily mean them to be synonyms, although if the court doesn't say it, it's hard to always know what they have in fact considered, and there are inferences that have to be drawn based on sometimes the other things that are said at sentencing. So in this case, for example, the court references some of the charges that were dismissed, and he acknowledges that there was conduct that resulted in charges being dismissed, and he also acknowledges that those things were dismissed. Now, whether or not he considered that and that equated to something that was in his analysis when he pronounced sentence, it seems like that was something that he considered.
Was that improper for him to consider?
I believe that in that instance, it was improper for him to consider that conduct. So Mr. Blaha reached a plea agreement with the state, and certainly while a court can consider the nature of the circumstances, and that's something that's explicitly in the statute and also in the case law to consider the nature of the circumstances, Mr. Blaha never conceded or entered into any sort of written plea agreement that the state could have proved met its burden on those additional counts. So in this case, I'm referring to shooting at other individuals involved in the charges of the attempted assault and the additional counts of use.
In sentencing on plea agreements, don't courts routinely consider uncharged or no longer charged conduct?
I would say yes, they do.
And why is that improper?
Well, I think it's improper because there's no finding that that conduct in fact happened. And in this case, Mr. Blaha disputes that that information, that that set of facts did happen and that that should have been charged at all in the information. So in this case, you have an initial police report, you have your on-scene police report saying that this level of conduct occurred, and that's included in the pre-sentence investigation report, which of course the court then received and could review. You have later reports where it's less clear. One of those individuals said they thought they were being shot at. Whether or not they were in fact shot at and that the state could have proved those things is entirely unclear based on the police reports that the court received. And so I think in this instance, given the uncertainty of what in fact happened, you have some things that are very clear, and then you have other counts that could have been and were dismissed for very good reason. And I think it's improper for a court to speculate on those things. He gave voice to it, and we don't know that there is a finding that the state could have even proved those things, and yet Mr. Blaha most likely was held accountable for additional conduct. His conduct that he was convicted of and that he was sentenced on was tragic, and it was horrible, But to then hold him accountable for other actions as part of that is an improper consideration. And I guess to your earlier point, he gave voice to it, and we don't know if that's something that was considered. He doesn't really connect. He kind of expresses, these are all the things that I've read through, these are all the things that I've looked
what
at.
What kind of record or objection do you make to the judge or to the pre-sentence investigation?
No objections were made by trial counsel to the pre-sentence investigation or to the commentary of the judge at the time of sentencing. Now, Mr. Blaha admittedly only has a qualified right to review his pre-sentence investigation report, and in this case, he didn't have the opportunity to discuss the pre-sentence investigation with his trial counsel.
He did or did not?
He did not. So he was unaware of those contents, and although it is a qualified right to review the pre-sentence investigation report, and by statute, an attorney certainly does not have to permit a defendant to review those materials, if you're looking at what an attorney should do in a circumstance like this, it's Mr. Blaha's position that he should have been afforded that opportunity, and a criminal attorney in that setting would have gone over those materials with him, because that is the information that's being reduced to writing. It's the culmination of an interview that sometimes the attorney is present at and sometimes not, and then that's reduced to writing, and it is something that certainly the court reads and reviews, and that's the most salient information that's provided to the court near sentencing. And Mr. Blaha, because he was unable to review that, did not object.
Who is statutorily authorized to review a pre-sentence investigation?
The court, I have to pull the statute exactly out. The defendant is not one of the people. The attorneys and the parties, the court, and then there's a provision,
the
I believe.
And the parties?
The attorneys. Excuse me. I didn't print it in front of me, but it's included. And so there is a provision where I believe you can apply to the court and under the court supervision allow a defendant to review the pre-sentence report. And that's typically not very practical. I mean, it simply is not. However, discussing the contents of what's included in, with your client is much easier. Going line by line through it, not always. But discussing generally, these are the high marks and these are the things that happened. Mr. Blaha wasn't afforded that opportunity, and so I don't believe he has waived the objection, although some of the case law would suggest that he has. He didn't engage in an exchange with the court at the time and wasn't specifically asked during his plea colloquy if he had reviewed that or talked about it in some of the case law. Those are explicit things that are discussed.
Oh, what's the error and who did it?
I think the error is with trial counsel.
So this is within the context of ineffective trial counsel. Right?
Yes. In addition, I guess back to the original point, I also think the court erred in discussing and relying on counts and taking into consideration and imposing a sentence based on conduct that had been dismissed and charges that had been dismissed.
Would this be harmless error, if it is error?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think it's harmless. In this case, Mr. Blaha received a substantial sentence, and his conduct was serious. And the crimes are serious, and the legislator gave discretion to the court, and it's a wide range. But I think taking into consideration a number of other offenses and that conduct, and laying that on top of and letting that inform your sentencing determination for the two crimes that he has been convicted is not harmless, because we don't know to what extent the court let that analysis, those considerations translate into the sentence that he imposed. So I think the big issue here is that the court didn't engage sufficiently in the analysis that's required, and the appellate court has the authority to review those considerations to the extent that they're known, but also to review and assess how the court applied those considerations. And in this case, Mr. Blaha is asking that you find the court in fact abused its discretion. I think the court gives some perfunctory and superficial analysis of the factors that it is to consider: age, mentality, motivation for the offense. But I think he tosses some of those things off rather quickly, and it's very unclear how those things tie to the sentence he ultimately gave. It's Mr. Blaha's position that a just sentence is one that can be tied rationally in some basis and to serve some rational purpose. So how that translates specifically into numbers here isn't clear.
Is it your position that a court could never consider conduct for charges that were dismissed, or there's something about this circumstance that should not have been?
It's the latter. In this case,
and
I think it's...
What makes this case special that the uncharged, dismissed conduct should not have been considered in sentence?
I think it's the evidence the court has in front of it in terms of the police reports. I think it's not clear. There's two additional counts of an attempted assault and two additional counts of a use. Those counts are dismissed, and those are what I believe the court is referencing at sentencing. But I think based on the police reports and the evidence it has before it, it's not at all clear what occurred. So I think you have conflicting evidence. If you're reading through the police reports, you have the initial reports indicate that these things occurred, and then you have supplemental reports and interviews of the two individuals that were at the scene that say, one explicitly, at least as it's reduced in writing by the officer interviewing him, that he thinks this may have happened, but he's not sure. And whereas the first assertion in the police report at the time the initial report is made makes it seem this absolutely happened, this is what we find, this is what happened, this is what we're told. But then the court also has the benefit of additional evidence in the pre-sentence investigation report. And so I think this circumstance is unique in that the court doesn't know. And so while there are other times you might have, through the information you have, a circumstance where you have more clarity and a state maybe could have proven those things and just decided to dismiss it for other reasons, in this case, it's just not clear. And so I think it's a unique circumstance in that regard. With that, I would simply ask that you consider Mr. Blaha's claims and that you remand this to the lower court to consider resentencing as consistent with Nebraska law and the factors the court should have considered in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska in this matter. This is a criminal case involving the defendant pleading in no contest to first-degree assault and use of a firearm to commit a felony, resulting out of an incident where the defendant shot a random victim in the back twice with a shotgun. The defendant alleges two assignments of error, that being ineffective assistance of counsel and excessive sentence. I intend to address two of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The other ineffective claims and the excessive sentence claim, I do not intend to address here today unless the court has specific questions that I can answer. So turning to the defendant's first ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that being that trial counsel failed to allow the defendant an opportunity to review the pre-sentence investigation report and failed to discuss any misrepresentations or erroneous characterizations in that report. The state's position on this claim is that it's without merit, as the defendant cannot show deficient performance and can also not show prejudice. Just briefly, it was mentioned a moment ago, there is a Nebraska revised statute that specifically identifies who is permitted to review a pre-sentence investigation report, and the Nebraska Court of Appeals has specifically held that the language in that statute is plain language and does not require an attorney to review a pre-sentence report with a defendant.
How does that square with our earlier case law and Boyer and McDermott?
I'm not familiar with the cases that you're referring to, but what I would point to, though, is that this court has repeatedly held, as mentioned previously, that any right the defendant has in reviewing a pre-sentence investigation report is a qualified right, and that the defendant must affirmatively assert that right at sentencing. Of course, in this case, he did not assert his desire to review the pre-sentence report personally, and as it's not required for a defense attorney to review it with a defendant, there is no deficient performance here. I would then note that there's one particular statement that the defendant points to that he takes issue with that was in the pre-sentence investigation report. He doesn't point to any other statements that he would have had an objection to. The statement that he identifies has to do with the reason why the offense was committed or his motivation for committing the offense, which has to do with his mental illness at the time the offense occurred. That statement is provided in the materials, so I won't repeat it here, but the defendant's trial counsel's failure to object to that statement is not deficient performance, because the statement itself is offered as a paraphrase statement of something that the defendant said during his interview with the pre-sentence interviewer. It's offered in the summary recommendation section of the pre-sentence investigation, and offered as an opinion or as a paraphrase of something the defendant stated, certainly is within the purview of a district court to consider. This court has held that a sentencing court has broad discretion in the evidence it considers at sentencing and determining and imposing a sentence, and that would be something that's well within the district court's province to consider. Additionally, the statement itself, when considered with the supplementary materials that were provided by the defendant's trial counsel, the statement is not an inaccurate statement. Additional materials were provided to the district court that were received, reviewed, and incorporated into the pre-sentence investigation, including Dr. Nuring's mental health evaluation and the defendant's own written statements to the court prior to sentencing. Those statements also speak to the defendant's mental health at the time the incident occurred. And to briefly reference some of the statements from Dr. Nuring's evaluation, that would include that the defendant was experiencing recurrent intrusive homicidal ideation, and to alleviate himself from this recurrent intrusive homicidal ideation, he inflicted harm on the victim by shooting him in the back while the victim was walking into work. He selected a random victim. They had never had contact before. And for whatever reason, he chose to do this to make himself feel better so that he didn't have these constant bombarding thoughts. That would be fully consistent with the defendant's own description of what he was experiencing at the time that he committed the offense. It's also consistent with the paraphrase statement that's included in the pre-sentence investigation report that he takes issue with. So for all of those reasons, the defendant's trial counsel was not deficient in not reviewing the pre-sentence report with him, assuming that that's actually what occurred, and also not objecting to that particular statement that the defendant takes issue with. Additionally,
is the defendant taking issue with the substance of the mental health information for the reason that there may have been a defense of, say, involuntariness or something to that effect? Not insanity going to the complete defense, but it, like, in voluntariness that might have gone to a defense of lack of intent.
I don't believe
that's what's on deck?
I don't believe that's what's being expressed by the defendant's brief. What's being expressed by the brief, and it's specifically stated in the brief, it's not so much that he's saying, I never said this, this isn't true. He's saying the pre-sentence investigation report writer misunderstood or misinterpreted something that he said during the interview. And I think he points specifically to the term self-gratify and most harm on another person, or inflicting the most harm on another person. He takes issue with the particular words that were used and how it was described. He's not taking issue, as I read it, with what's actually being expressed, which is completely consistent with the supplementary materials. So taking all of that information together, that would indicate, or it would have removed any possibility that the district court would have been misled or would have somehow misunderstood this paraphrase statement. And I think the record would indicate that the court was not misled by the statement. In fact, the court specifically references Dr. Nuring's evaluation when imposing sentence. And I think the most important factor here, at least for this particular claim, is that the defendant simply cannot show prejudice here. The district court was very clear at sentencing that the defendant's mental health at the time the offense was committed was a mitigating factor. And the sentence itself was mitigated or reduced because of the defendant's mental health. This paraphrase statement exactly references his mental health. And so the defendant simply cannot show that he was prejudiced by his counsel's alleged failure to review the pre-sentence report with him prior to sentencing, object to the paraphrase remark. Briefly referencing then the other ineffective claim that trial counsel failed to correct the state's factual basis offered at the time that the defendant entered his pleas. There's two facts here, and I'll just very briefly hit on this, that the state mistakenly interchanged two names in their factual basis, and that law enforcement found an image of a burning wallet on the defendant's cell phone. Neither of those facts are essential elements of either first-degree assault or use of a firearm to commit a felony. They were not necessary for the court to find beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty of both offenses. The two names reference the name of an informant. It's not required for the specific name of the informant to be provided at the factual basis. He could simply be called informant number one. The important information relayed there is that the defendant had confessed to this person that he had shot the victim on the date in question, and that's what's being expressed as part of that statement. His name is irrelevant. The image of the burning wallet, again, is not an element of either offense and is not necessary for the court to have found the defendant guilty. He also cannot show prejudice. He doesn't even allege that but for his trial counsel failing to object to those portions of the factual basis that he would have insisted on going to trial on all eight charges rather than accepting the plea agreement where six of those eight charges were dismissed and he was facing less than a third of the imprisonment time that he otherwise would have been facing. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is Maloli versus Central Nebraska Public Power and Irrigation.